This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Dr. Sue Elsperman, who's the statewide president of Ivy Tech Community College. They've just come up with a five-year strategic plan for growth and to add more students over time. We'll find out more about that plan from Dr. Elsperman. Also, a conversation with the speaker who is attending a discussion tomorrow on the IU Northwest campus in Gary, which is entitled The Trans Veterans Perspective. We'll talk with Rhiannon Carlson about that and more coming up on Regionally Speaking. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Ivy Tech Community College has just launched a five-year strategic plan. What kind of impact will it have for Northwest Indiana? Well, let's find out from the boss, from Dr. Sue Elsperman, who's with us from her office. Thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today. I know that this is a very, very ambitious goal or set of goals, actually, that you have for Ivy Tech Community College. Will you take a little time first and tell us more about the five-year strategic plan, how it's come about, and whether it's some of the goals that you're hoping to reach in the next 5 years?
To be clear to many, the state of Indiana is really counting on Ivy Tech. We are the nation's largest singly accredited community college. We cover the entire state. There in Northwest Indiana, we have three significant campuses, the Lake County, Valpo, and Michigan City campuses, all serving well, but we cover the entire state. So as you understand, our employers are needing middle skills workforce with great need out there, and we have been working with the General Assembly trying to line up our programs to make sure that they are those high-wage, high-demand, in-demand jobs. And so we have founded our strategic plan really on two premises. One is the Lumina goal, which the state has adopted, understanding that going forward, more than 60% of our workforce will require post-secondary degrees or credentials, and has set that goal for 2025. Half of those, we think, is in the sub-baccalaureate, two-year and less kinds of degrees and credentials. So if you just make that into an annual number, we picked kind of 50,000 out of that we think is Ivy Tech's portion. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Governor Holcomb, on his State of the State address, talked about 1 million more jobs that will be available across Indiana over the next 10 years, half of those requiring post-secondary degrees and credentials. So again, you have this 50,000 jobs a year that are going to require some post-secondary degree or certification or certificate. So both ways, we understand and have adopted as our vision, our big goal is to get to 50,000 degrees or credentials per year. Today, we are at 21,182. That's a pretty big lift for us as an institution, but one that we have a system that's capable of doing that, particularly if we focus heavily in those high-wage, high-demand areas that our employers are clamoring for and that will provide the really good jobs for Hoosiers to have prosperous incomes. Mm-hmm.
In those particular areas, what jobs or types of jobs are you discovering, and of course is going to be part of the overall plan, that you want to either add as far as to the curriculum or that you're already having in the curriculum you're going to try to beef up, so to speak, to be able to meet the demand for the jobs?
Yeah, so that's the really good news is that Ivy Tech has most of the programs that are in those high-wage, high-demand areas, and they include mm-hmm. things like industrial maintenance, and you have programs there like Steel Workers for the Future, and that all we have the programs in technology like IT, in healthcare like nursing. So we have welding in certainly in high demand across all of our manufacturing employers and building trades, and of course building trades are growing. So we have the programs. We don't have enough, quite honestly, enough students walking in the door right now to come into those programs. So we are shifting our strategy significantly to really deliberately recruit into those programs, and we welcome our employers to help us do that as well so that we can attract not only the 18-year-olds, but many more adults out there. So you may know that we have over 700,000 Hoosiers across our state with some college but no degree. We'd love to help those get to a meaningful degree or credential. And then we have well over a million that have no college at all that are in their middle career years and would be able and very capable of taking on these middle skills jobs if they came back and got that. Anything from a six-month kind of commitment to get a meaningful certificate up to the full associate degree with a two-year degree. So we really encourage those that are out there. The governor rolled out his next level jobs, which actually makes it free for people to come back, adults to come back into these high wage, high demand jobs. And if your listeners want to get on nextleveljobs.org, they can find directly what the long list of these, what are called four flame and five flame jobs are, very hot, if you will, jobs for the state of Indiana. So that's very exciting. We have those programs. We want to recruit more students in, and we'll continue campus by campus to make sure that we have exactly those programs that are needed for the employers in that service area. And in fact, that was part of our restructure this year, is to really make sure that each of our campuses have the autonomy that's needed and can focus on those jobs. So that's the big goal. Mm-hmm. But then within it, it's absolutely about helping to, as we talked about enrollment, enrolling those numbers of students that we need in order to have that 50,000 completions each year to meet the workforce needs. And so we're very excited to roll this out across the state.
We're talking with Dr. Sue Elsperman, who is the statewide president of Ivy Tech Community College, and talking about the new five-year strategic plan that is going to not only help the college statewide, but here in Northwest Indiana, to be able to make itself available for those people, adults as well as young people, who are interested in the jobs of the future as they develop, and the ones, some of the ones that are out there already. Dr. Elsperman, in talking with the folks up here in Northwest Indiana, I know you were up here recently for one of the board meetings that was held in Michigan City. Did they spend any time talking with you about, more specifically, about their opportunities that are available for people to work in Northwest Indiana, and knowing that we can, as looking for the experience and get the educational opportunities as well, that Ivy Tech Community College can jump in and fill the gap, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. I know you have some amazing employers in Northwest Indiana, the big employers like BP and ArcelorMittal and Praxis Air. There's so many good employers that are there, and we want to serve all, from the small ones to the large ones. And boy, healthcare, the needs in our healthcare systems to, as we baby boomers age here, we need ever more of those employees, from medical assisting to surge techs, et cetera. So we have, yes, we've got a great regional board there that is doing good work, and our task is to have those campuses in Northwest Indiana, those three campuses, really meet the needs of each of their immediate communities, but collectively cover the needs of Northwest Indiana. I may mention that one of our interesting metrics going forward that I don't think you'll see any other two-year or four-year college in Indiana or the Midwest measure themselves on are actual wages of our students when they complete. Mm-hmm. So our commitment is not just to help a student get to that degree or completion, but to ensure that they're successfully and that they have a job that offers prosperity. So we've begun measuring our graduates. We know today that 38% of our graduates 1 year out are making more than the median income in Indiana. We want to bump that number up to 80% over the next 5 years, so that if we are truly lining up our programs to those that employers, those many great employers you have in the area, then these individuals will come out making those wages. You've probably seen the billboards in Northwest Indiana for ArcelorMittal on what a steel worker makes today, you know, that $90,000 or $95,000 a year. So those are incredible wages and incomes for families to prosper. And we want to ensure that every case we're helping to direct our students into those kind of programs that will offer the employers the workforce they need, but our students the kinds of futures that they seek as well.
I know you talk about the Steelworker of the Future program that's underway. That's an interesting program that has been going on for quite some time here, and I know that that Ivy Tech Community College has been working very closely with ArcelorMittal, and I'm sure the other steel companies in the region, or if they haven't, they will be, I'm sure, to offer something similar at their facilities as well. And they probably found that this has been a very successful program.
It is, and again, as I have the opportunity to speak to your many listeners, we would encourage many more of both our 18-year-olds and young adults that are out there who want to look for that ever greater career opportunity, that yes, we have an amazing steelmaking industry there in Northwest Indiana, but we have amazing employers in those areas like industrial maintenance and welding, and the tech areas are so ripe to ensure that we can help fill important jobs and help our Hoosiers move into great incomes as well.
Well, Dr. Ellsperman, it sounds like that the Ivy Tech Community College, with the basis for this 5-year strategic plan well underway and working on getting the regions off and running as well, too, that you're off to a good start for being able to reach the goals that you've set, certainly, and the goals that Governor Holcomb has put forth here, and wanting to be sure that not only have all the jobs in Indiana that can be had, but also the opportunities for people to go to work in those jobs. Thank you very much for spending time to give us an update on the strategic plan and how things are pertaining here in Northwest Indiana.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today.
We're talking with Dr. Sue Ellsperman, who is the statewide president of Ivy Tech Community College. Children aren't the only ones benefiting from Indiana's state-funded pre-K program. On My Way Pre-K, as it's called, got started in 5 counties, including Lake County. It did well, and the state expanded it to 15 more counties. Officials say that the goal is to continue expanding, but as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright tells us, there are still issues to work through in order to be able to have more communities to feel the impact.
Education advocates praise the benefits of quality pre-K. It not only prepares young children for kindergarten, it teaches them social skills, how to balance their emotions, and more. Jeff Harris is the director of public affairs at Early Learning Indiana, a nonprofit advocate. He says quality pre-K can even save money for some community-wide issues.
For every $1 we invest in early education, it's a $4 savings down the road. That's a savings in everything from criminal justice to the social safety net type savings for that person, because they become more productive over the long run.
But it's not just the children who are benefiting from On My Way Pre-K. Recent studies show parents benefit as well, because it's a stable childcare option. That holds true for Kendra Harper. Her daughter Bailey went through the program in Marion County. Bailey's an only child, and Kendra noticed she became more independent.
She was able to, deal with other children better, handle her emotions. She was almost ready to read when she came out of pre-K.
But Bailey attending pre-K also helped Kendra finish up her law degree and work part-time at the Attorney General's office. She had peace of mind knowing Bailey was being taken care of.
And it did give me an opportunity to complete a host of internships and clerkships throughout law school, because experience really matters. So without her going to the Reliable Center, we probably wouldn't have been able to do all of that.
Data shows more than 27,000 low-income kids in Indiana don't have access to quality pre-K. But the state is slowly starting to change that. Governor Eric Holcomb approved 15 more counties last summer to participate in On My Way Pre-K. Monroe County is among them, and launched its program this month. Tina Peterson is the president and CEO of the Community Foundation of Bloomington and Monroe County. She says 50 spots opened for families.
When this program came along at 127% of poverty, we thought, number one, thank goodness that we as a state are finally getting there, and number two, we'll have plenty of kids for this program.
But Peterson says it's been shocking. Not even a third of the grants have been filled. On the surface, she says, the application process is simple. Parents can just log in and apply online. She shows me on her own computer.
If we click on the link for the application, so it's going to ask for family information, names, date of birth, language spoken. They're going to ask about your family size, your family's monthly earned income.
But as Peterson scrolls through the pages, she says some families don't even have a computer or internet access. There's also a lot of paperwork involved.
The language that we're using isn't always understandable. And this is, of course, language that's being used across the state, and all those communities are doing that. So I think there's some things that we can do to improve and make that process more user-friendly. And I think we feel very hopeful about that.
In addition to meeting income requirements, parents also must be working or be taking part in educational training. Peterson says that's another challenge to combat. And these are just some of the issues Peterson sees. Monroe County's enrollment period ends this weekend, and plenty of spots sit open. There could be as many as 200 spots to fill in the fall. Peterson hopes the state can work to make it easier for families so more kids benefit.
Early learning really shouldn't be an option for kids. It's just a very important part of the continuum of learning for kids.
That, she says, will have a ripple effect on the entire community. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Legislators have proposed a bill that would relax some of the eligibility requirements. It would no longer require parents to work or be seeking employment or participate in educational training. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The computer science field is booming, and yet women are still underrepresented within. Research shows that one reason is that girls are not as exposed to computer science in K-12 education. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting Charlotte Tuggle reports in the first of a two-part series, universities are reaching out to schools to introduce computing a little earlier than usual.
And when we push the play button, it'll do whatever it says.
That's Kira Southard, one of three girls at Terre Haute's Lost Creek Elementary School, building a robot after classes have ended for the day. The other groups are all made up of boys, but that doesn't bother Southard.
All the boys are getting a little wild, but we like to get stuff done.
The project is part of Makerspace Club, a program aimed at introducing kids to computer science. After the robot is assembled, they'll be able to program it to move using a tablet computer. David Fisher, a Rose Holman Institute of Technology computer science professor, is a mentor for the program. He also organizes a summer camp for elementary and middle school students to introduce them to coding.
Whenever we kind of make the advertisement, we'll try to emphasize the fact that you can really do something with it, which tends to attract girls better, and also the opportunity for creativity tends to attract girls better.
He says the first year they held the camp, there was an even gender split in the elementary school group. But in the middle school group, there was just one girl who registered, so they had to even it up via extra recruitment. A recent study shows when many girls stop thinking about computer science. The data suggests it happens most in high school, either because computing isn't taught or it's no longer enjoyable to girls. But university officials are trying to combat both of those issues. Many have thrown their support behind Governor Eric Holcomb's proposal to require a computer science class in every high school. Purdue University senior Yonka Gall went to a high school that did offer CS classes. Before then, she hadn't even realized that she could major in computer science. Gall, like many other women in the field, was more invested once she heard about computing's real-world applications, such as the app she created in class that she can use to make digital scrapbooks.
I think it looks nice and it works, and so it's like cool to have something that I helped make and that does something and that we like made from scratch.
That's exactly what universities are stressing during a major rebranding of CS. Purdue distributes targeted marketing materials to prospective female students. They feature women in the department, as well as student organizations and careers for so-called changemakers. Back at Rose Holman, CS professor David Mutchler is focusing on breaking stereotypes, specifically referencing the longtime use of video games in computer science imagery.
Video games then, and still today, are largely directed at boys. There are some great games for girls now, but there were none 10 years ago. So that image is what kept us from getting anywhere.
That image of the boys' club still persists, though. For example, according to Computer Science for All, a federal program aimed at increasing diversity in CS, male computer scientists and engineers outnumber women 5-1 on television. And in family films, the disparity is nearly three times as wide. Rose Holman engineering professor Carlotta Berry says despite being exposed to computer science, that kind of portrayal has a lasting ability to turn girls away from the field.
There's this image that stuff's for boys. boys program, boys are good at math, boys are good at science, girls shouldn't do that stuff. So once they get that stigma in their mind, it's kind of really hard to get them back.
Universities have focused on getting girls attracted to computer science early, then sustaining that interest until it's time to pick a college. Purdue and Rose Holman both report increases in female computer science students in the past few years. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle in West Lafayette.
Charlotte will continue her series tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking. Federal lawmakers continue to fight over the future of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that protects immigrants brought into the country illegally as children. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle tells us the uncertainty is stalling legislation that would make attending college easier for students in Indiana.
Indiana is one of just three states with a law that prohibits state colleges and universities from offering in-state tuition to undocumented high school graduates. Instead, they must pay the out-of-state or international rate, a cost that can be three times more. Democrat state lawmakers want to overturn that 2011 law.
We have this opportunity here to clarify state law, and we want to make sure that we at least have this option if everything falls apart at the federal level.
That's Democrat Senator Mark Stoops. He's wrote one of the four bills this session that would give undocumented graduates in-state tuition.
I just find it hard to believe that we can't say, well, we can help you with this next step. We're not helping you with tuition. We're just letting you pay the in-state rate because you were an in-state student.
That change could help Gustavo Flores.
So we're in Shortridge IB, IB World School.
The Indianapolis Shortridge High School senior is one of the nearly 10,000 students and others approved for DACA in Indiana. President Trump has ordered the Obama-era program to end on March 5th, and Congress is at odds over how to fix it.
It's a very fearful thing because, like, at any given time after my DACA expires, it's like I could be deported. And what if I take out a loan to go, like, to one of these colleges, and then I get deported, and then I have these loans in America, but I can't pay them, and it's like, what happens then?
Flores was brought to America from Mexico when he was one. Shortly after, his family moved to Indianapolis. He's attended Indianapolis public schools since he was a child. A reason his family came here, he says, is for him to have opportunities, like college.
If I want to do something for me, something to give back to the community, I want to become a doctor so I can help people.
Flores hopes Indiana will join other states that offer in-state tuition to undocumented students. Most Indiana colleges offer the resident rate to DACA recipients. But if the program goes away, Flores says, he and others won't be able to afford to attend. His school guidance counselor, Nathan Ellis, agrees that barriers are steep for these students.
You know, when it comes to finances, it just doesn't work out because of not being able to pay for it because they didn't get scholarships or they're paying out-of-state tuition. And it's frustrating to see students get kind of demoralized throughout the year and maybe not even choose to apply because they don't see the point.
It's a long shot if Stoops' bill or any of the legislation will be heard this year. There's little to no support in the State House. Republican leaders say they don't see the point. Here's Dennis Cruz, chairman of the Senate Education Committee.
That issue is basically a federal government issue. It's really not designed to be a state government issue, and so hopefully the federal government will take action and give us direction on what to do.
Since there is a law that prohibits the state colleges from offering in-state tuition, from my reading, it seems like that law could be chained to the state issue.
Well, it can be, yes, but I prefer, as the chairman, to have the federal government take action on this issue next.
Back at Shortridge High School, Flores says he's trying to stay focused amidst the national and local debate that will affect his future.
These paintings are basically a color wheel.
He's showing me a series of small paintings he's finishing up for an upcoming senior art show.
It's a good distraction just to keep my mind at ease, just level myself out.
But he's still frustrated.
Yeah, I'm going to keep my hopes up, but not too high up because if something like were to like not happen in my favor, I don't want to be so high up that the fall is going to like just devastate me, if that makes sense.
Congressional Republicans and Democrats pledge to find a permanent fix on DACA by February 8th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I am Eric Weddle.
According to the National Center for Transgender Equality, it's been estimated that more than 134,000 American veterans are transgendered, and more than 15,000 trans men and women are serving in military service these days. One of those transgendered Americans and veterans is with us, who's going to be offering her experiences and information to a seminar that's coming up here on January 30th at IU Northwest in Gary. Rhiannon Carlson is with us. Rhiannon, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, I understand that you're going to have quite a speech that you're going to give and a discussion that you're going to lead as well for this event coming up in the Savannah Center at IU Northwest on Tuesday, January 30th. And a lot of this will, I'm sure, center around your personal experiences. You served in the armed forces during the 2003 Iraq conflict. Let's first talk, if we may, about yourself and your personal experiences being a transgendered woman.
Transgendered isn't really a word, and in the past tense. So transgender is the right way to say that.
We'll start first with just what led you to believe that your life was different from the way that you were born.
There's over 100 conditions right now where XX doesn't equal female and XY doesn't equal male. But that being said, I mean, this understanding of who I was goes all the way back to my very first memory. And it's been inseparable. It's been an inseparable part of my entire life. And it's been something that I had to live with in secret my entire life out of fear. Because I knew in our society, we are one of the first things we learn to identify is gender norms. And when you don't fit that norm, you learn very well that you learn very quickly that it's very dangerous to cross that line. And I came from a very conservative part of the state and a very conservative family, good people, but just not, this isn't something that they're familiar with. So I hid it most of my life. I would say that going into the military, while with like everyone who's joined the military, it's a multifaceted decision. No one issue is the one issue that gets someone to go in, whether it's economic, whether it's values of duty, patriotism, whether it's just getting out of your hometown, all of those things are true, or college money again, all those things for me were true as well. But then on top of that, I also had this gender thing going on where the military is seen as the height of masculine achievement in America. Whether that's right or wrong is not really necessarily the point. The feeling being, though, is that you have something to prove, or at least for me, I had something to prove. Prove to myself and prove to the world. In effect, I was basically running away from myself. And it was a way of running. And I've heard other trans activists say, and I agree with, that the experience of being trans in America is it's like running a race, and you run as fast as you can, but eventually you get too tired. And when you get too tired and wear down, then you have to face reality. You have to face who you are. You have no other choice. Mm-hmm. So for me, joining the military was influenced a lot by that.
When you have a chance now to look back here on your experiences while you're in the service, obviously you feel proud that you served. You just felt that your experiences and the way that you felt as a person, yourself, as well as maybe possibly political views too, if you had a difference then.
Yeah, I would say I had a difference back then. Mm-hmm. My views were more narrow back in those days. Had the blinders on, I suppose, but I would say that for me, when I was in, and this is my experience on, I cannot generalize to all trans people who've served. While I was in the military, I was pretty insular, and I was respected in my job, but I was seen as a little bit different from the other infantry folks in my platoon. Not hated, never harassed. At all, but definitely seen as someone who operated differently. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I was a machine gunner, 240 Bravo machine gunner, and I'm a very small framed person. And it wasn't because I was the toughest; it was just because I used different strengths, if you will. I was often called "You're like an officer, Carlson." So, definitely didn't have that macho view, but definitely had a drive to succeed and to prove myself, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, once you finished your time in the service, you mm-hmm. left the service and became an undergraduate at Purdue University. I take it with the main campus in West Lafayette. Did you get involved in veterans groups there, and then perhaps even further with transgender groups there as well?
Well, I was I wasn't out back in those days,
yeah.
But when I was there, I was an undergrad in political science, and was getting a minor in history, and I noticed that there were other vets in my class and who were either history majors and political science minors or whatever, but we had a lot of similar classes. And you can tell who the veteran is on campus, the swag that's on their backpacks, the look and the way they carry themselves. And so I'm like, well, these people are around and they clearly have the same experience as I do, so why not strike up conversations with them? There were no veteran clubs back in those days, at least not at Purdue, and they were very rare at campuses around the country as well. So like, well, hey, let's just hang out and talk. And sometimes it would be just like, well, let's go have a beer. Like, you know, you might want to. But then it might go into, well, wait, there's some serious issues here on campus. Let's start addressing them. Why shouldn't we be addressing them? We're vets. This is what we do. And then it kind of just grows from there, and we started a veterans club. We're like, other people have clubs. Why not us? Why not we have a club? And then that kind of started the real push towards advocacy for change and at both the institutional level but also at the state and national level.
I know, too, that this obviously led you to being involved in veterans groups, and now that you're actually working as one, you're, in fact, the veterans program coordinator at IU South Bend, and you're bringing your experiences, no doubt, in helping organize the organization in West Lafayette to South Bend over, and your experiences there as a veteran as well, too, aren't you?
I'm certainly trying to, It was definitely one of the pushes that we had back in those days was to create these veterans offices, not just to be able to certify benefits, but also to be areas of providing resources on both the campus and in the community, to have someone in the administration work as an ombudsman with the faculty, and being able to help people understand deployment schedules and things like that, or just the realities of being a veteran and the challenges that some of these people face, both in social integration, the physical and mental health needs that may be need to be addressed because of service, and all sorts of other factors, and then also just have a place for them to socialize. One of the great things about education in this world is that it helps you grow as a human being. And I do believe in the power of education for the veteran to come back to also grow and heal when they come back from war. But they also need a chance to kind of dip their toes in, if you will, and to integrate with the larger campus community. They still need to maintain their identity as who they are. And so these spaces are also a place for them to come unwind and socialize commune, I guess, with their other fellow vets. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Rhiannon Carlson, who is with the IU South Bend staff. She is coming over to IU Northwest on Tuesday to talk about her experiences as a person as well as an Army veteran to a group that's meeting over at the Savannah Center at IU Northwest. And I'm sure you're bringing your experiences as a veteran as well as a transgender woman over to talk about the issues. The latest issues I know that have come up here, including the ones that's before the General Assembly now, is dealing with the hate crimes problem across Indiana. And there have been some modifications to a bill that is now going through the General Assembly that would exclude trans people, trans men and women, from the provisions in the measure, and it would kind of make some substitutions that you feel are probably mistaken. Tell us a little bit about the changes that you see that are being made and the impact it would have.
Well, sure. During the political process, when they're drafting these bills and trying to negotiate what they're going to allow in and what they're going to cut, it's common, and it was the same as 2 years ago when they were talking about creating an inclusive bill to a non-discrimination bill against LGBT people 2 years ago. But gender identity is one that always gets brought up as being problematic and that they want to cut from these bills. Well, it's no different than what's going on right now with SB 314, the hate crime legislation. They want to cut gender identity, which basically is transgender human beings, transgender humans, and these are the most targeted people for violence and unemployment and homelessness, for a whole slew of issues in society, and all of them stem from misunderstanding and hate. These are the most vulnerable people in our country, and yet they want to carve that out. And then they want to add law enforcement officers. Law enforcement officers, while yes, they have a job that puts them in danger, that's their job. They volunteered for that, and they also hold state power. It's kind of confusing to me that they should be added to be a protected class of people when they hold state power, and then the most marginalized people in the country are being carved out of that to not be protected. It boggles the mind.
Well, certainly this is going to in turn be one of the more watched measures going through the General Assembly this time. And I know that even though some people have said before the session started, we're not going to take up any major issues like that. We knew that sooner or later this issue would have to come back up. And it's certainly interesting that it should come back up this far along into the session. So we'll all be watching that to see what happens. And I'm sure you're going to definitely talk about that when you come to IU Northwest here for your presentation.
Well, certainly, and also it's my understanding that Brian Bosma is the one who brought up addressing the hate crimes legislation, and for that he should be commended, because that was very unexpected. And so I think that there are people who are pushing for the right things. It's just when in the negotiation processes, they talk about, well, they just try to carve people out, and it's confusing to me.
Now, who are bringing you into the Gary campus for your presentation?
Yeah, so my understanding is it's less of a presentation, more of just a guided discussion and a talk with the Women and Gender Studies program and anybody else who would like to be involved in that talk. So it should be fairly informal, and look forward to having as many people who want to engage in discussion to come.
That's right. It's going to happen again on Tuesday, the 30th. It's going to be in the Savannah Center. And by the way, if you do want to attend, it's in rooms 205 and 206. So look for that when you get into the building there on the Gary campus. We've been talking with Rhiannon Carlson, who is the Veterans Program Coordinator as well as a counselor at IU South Bend. She's coming over to the Gary campus for being involved in the discussion, which is entitled Advocating for LGBTQI Rights at IU and the State of Indiana. And Rhiannon, I hope you have a chance that you'll enjoy your visit over to Gary for the presentation. And thank you for spending time talking about yourself and about the issues involving transgender people.
Well, thank you, Chris, and can't wait to come over.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking. Let's check in with Northwest Indiana political and community activist Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking again today.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure.
Well, I'll let you get started here. You've got your agenda. Fire away.
Okay. I have been reflecting on of, by, and for the people, and the failure in our democracy that seems to have gotten larger. And there's a lot of recent examples, not to mention, because I'm sure lots of people will talk about it, the president's comments, which were hair-raising in their racist clarity. And certainly a president who thinks that black people should not come to the United States and Norwegians should probably doesn't think that those people here deserve the same rights and opportunities as others. And that kind of went along with his promotion of making people work to get Medicaid. Now, I have a nephew on Medicaid who cannot work. The reason he's on Medicaid is because he's on Social Security disability. And to try and find or force people to work who can't work is criminal. But I want to mention a couple other things. I think a lot of the listeners might know that Peggy Hinckley, our emergency manager, now will be the person who decides on filling the vacancy in the school board. This public schools were kind of the keynote of democracy, that everyone could go, they were close by, they were available. We're about to have one high school in the entire city of Gary. Mm-hmm. And she is about to name the person who will serve on the school board, even though the school board does not have any authority or power. We are watching the death of the most important institution in our country. And with it will go democracy. The other thing that was on my list here is this lawsuit that was filed against the city of Gary because it passed a welcoming ordinance. Now, that ordinance says nothing about the city refusing to cooperate with the federal government, with ICE and immigration. What it says, which is part of the law, is that our police can't do the work of the federal immigration authorities, and it would be a violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution that says you can't commandeer local police forces to do federal work. And you can just imagine, with our shortages and our deficits, if our police were running around raiding 7-Elevens like ICE does, where would public safety in the city of Gary be? That is just another aspect of democracy, but it's more than that, because the lawsuit was filed out of Indianapolis based on an alleged violation of a state preemption law. Let me explain preemption. Yeah. It means state preempts, stops, overrides what local cities and counties do. Now, in our Constitution in the state of Indiana, we have a chapter called Home Rule, which says counties and cities should be able to make the laws to govern themselves. And certainly a welcoming ordinance, which is not exactly the same as a sanctuary city, was an expression of Gary's desire to be an open and welcoming community where people will move into our empty homes, will take jobs, and will help to rebuild our city. But this lawsuit says that we can't do anything if the state doesn't like it. And, you know, we have the same kind of preemption law on minimum wage. So Indianapolis says $7.25. You can't live on $7.25 anywhere in the state, but most certainly not in Northwest Indiana. Yeah. And so to preempt local home rule is about as undemocratic as it gets. So I'm very concerned. I don't think this lawsuit can fly. I think it will be dismissed because it stands on all kinds of weak and flaky ground. But anyhow, and then the last point that has bothered me, how can citizens of the United States, 6 months after a hurricane, still not have electricity in Puerto Rico? Are they not human beings, or does our president think they're like Haitians, and why do we let them come here anyway? This is another attack on human basic rights in our country. We have the right to be able to read, which you need light for, to live in comfort, which you need electricity for, and yet with all of our resources, the island of Puerto Rico is in the dark, and now the death toll is well over 1,000 because people are dying from drinking putrid water because they don't have electricity, they can't get water. And also, they're dying from disease because they have no electricity and no access to care. So I think we should be very concerned in 2018 that if we do not get active, if we do not stand up and say, this is not right, we will lose our democracy completely and we'll end up with a little dictator who can tell us who can live here, who can't, who can work in our public school system, who can't. I mean, we will have no local self-governance, and we will lose our rights. The week of February 19th, it's Black Labor Week, and it's part of Black History Month. But what is important is that Black labor in particular is facing really deteriorating conditions. Some people might have read about the Ford stamping plant where women, talking about the Women's March and Me Too,
right. Mm-hmm.
Where women are being harassed not only by the company, but even by the union. and the union is doing nothing. We need a week of education and service because I think that the racism of our president has been the main thing to trickle down and to awaken really dehumanizing feelings and thoughts in our population. People go online to A. Philip Randolph, Northwest Indiana, and get the schedule for Black Labor Week. There'll be panels, there'll be movies, there'll be even a great celebration on Friday night, the 23rd, and learn about what is happening in our Black communities and in our workplaces. Campus, we're going to do it both in Westville and Hammond and talk through satellite. The next demonstration at the airport in Gary. They have increased the deportations. There's no longer two buses. There's now three buses and other vehicles. They have taken protection away from Salvadorians, from Haitians, from Hondurans, and all of these people are going to be deported, and all of it for the whole Chicago area, the deportations leave from our airport every Friday morning at 10 o'clock. February 23rd, coinciding with Black Labor Week, we will be out at the airport to say no more deportations, protect DACA, and you might know that even the Ninth Circuit Court said, No. This elimination of protection for DACA causes irreparable harm and therefore should be overturned, and there's a block against it. We are going to put on an art exhibit called Art of Resistance and Resilience in Northwest Indiana, and we are looking for Northwest Indiana artists and activists. So your picket signs, your poems, your songs, your paintings, your photographs, anything you want to submit. And the jury, there will be a jury, but it's not going to say who's the best artist. It's going to look at how well the art reflects the spirit of struggle of the people in Northwest Indiana.
That's Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. Time now for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Donna Catalano, my co-worker at South Shore Arts. Donna, you are in charge of our grant program and through our regional arts partnership with the Indiana Arts Commission, and you've been doing this for quite a number of years.
Actually, 10 years, and it was in September.
10 years?
Yes.
10 years plus?
Yes.
And so this grant program whereby South Shore Arts distributes money, this is state allotted money from the General Assembly through the Indiana Arts Commission and then trickling on down through us for Lake Porter and LaPorte counties for organizations, nonprofit organizations, either arts organizations or other kinds of nonprofits that are interested in receiving funding for arts projects.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And
take it away.
The funding actually originates with the National Endowment of the Arts, which gives every state money based on per capita. And then the state is required to match that and then distribute it through all the state. And so since Indiana has 92 counties, we are Region 1, which is Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. And outside of Indianapolis, we have the most dense population. So we have the second largest amount of grant money to give away. Last year, we gave away over $250,000 in grant money. And so we're excited about this new year. Last year, we had 40 grantees, and we're looking to do the same this year, probably. As you mentioned, there are arts projects support funding, which goes up to, they can receive up to $5,000 for a non-arts organization that does arts projects. So we have several of those. We have the Dunes Learning Center does art camp in the summer. Boys and Girls Clubs have art programming that we help with. There's a dance company in East Chicago, folklore dancing with Deborah Bolaños in East Chicago. So we do a lot of fun things with municipalities, other schools, just people that do good things.
Well, we should say that even Eye on the Arts is supported.
Yes, it is.
Through a grant that is submitted every year by Lakeshore Public Media. And both the TV and I assume our radio interviews are also covered by that application.
Mm-hmm.
So so it's a wide range of projects whereby the arts are used to help enrich people's lives.
Right, and the project grants are for projects whose organization has a budget of an income budget averaged over 3 years of under $50,000. Mm-hmm. After $50,000 and you have arts in your mission statement, you would go up to an arts organization grant. And there's two levels in that. $50,000 to $250,000 is AOS, Art Organization Support 1. And then if you, after $250,000, you go up to a higher level, mm-hmm. and you can ask for up to $20,000 in funding. Mm-hmm. And we have like five or six of those. Mm-hmm. So we're very fortunate. We don't realize sometimes how common and good arts are in this region.
Right, how they proliferate.
Yes, and they're a great economic driver.
Absolutely. So some of the larger organizations in our region include the Lebesnik Center in Michigan City.
Yes.
Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, mm-hmm. Theater at the Center in Munster.
Yep. Chicago Street Theater.
Chicago Street Theater is,
yes,
on that level.
Absolutely.
Now.
And then LaPorte County Symphony.
Okay.
And Gloria Tuohy and Indiana Ballet.
Okay. So those five that we fund. Mm-hmm. And then South Shore Arts itself, mm-hmm. Which is funded directly by the Indiana Arts Commission.
Yes.
So, and then we have numerous organizations through all three counties in the AOS 1 level as well. This partnership began, it came out of a strategic planning cycle that the Indiana Arts Commission executed back in the mid-90s. They were criticized justifiably for focusing so much of their money on Indianapolis, the collar counties, maybe a little bit down in Brown County and mm-hmm. Bloomington. And this structure, whereby they identified originally 12 partners throughout the state, helped to distribute the funding more equitably,
yes,
based on population.
And we're happy since we get the second most amount of money, so we're very happy in Region 1.
And some of our partner organizations have to have like 16 counties,
yes,
in their region.
Yes, just south of us in Lafayette, Tippecanoe Arts Federation, I think she has 14 counties.
Mm-hmm.
And you get some counties with no arts programming. And it's,
right,
the rural areas are actually underserved areas.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been targeting those rural areas in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And we've been partnering, Indiana Arts Commission has been partnering with OCRA in trying to get those money out to rural counties.
So the deadline is March 1st.
March 1st is the deadline.
The system
is online.
Yep.
Anybody can email me. You can go on our homepage, on our website, on the bottom right corner. You can find all the links you need.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's online. It's very simple.
It is easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's
mm-hmm.
for programs that will take place between July 1st of 2018 and June 30th of 2019.
Yes. And we do panel these grants. We have a panel. We panel them separately. Project supports are separate from the other ones. And then that meets, I think it's the first Saturday in May, we will panel those. You'll get your notification of funding in July, and then hopefully money, they say October, but it's usually December.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks, Donna, for coming in and telling us about the grant opportunity. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
It's John Kane talking with Donna Catalano of South Shore Arts. You can catch these Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.